This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oakland.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Pena.
Good afternoon once again, everybody, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, my producer, Lee Della Pina, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. And for those joining us throughout North America on Sirius Channel 93, welcome to the show. And welcome back to everybody that has been with us for the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage on XM 208. Of course, you can always tune in to HRN every time we are on the air live with our streaming at horseracingradio.net and, of course, podcast at horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. 7 days a week, 365 days a year. That is the work schedule of a thoroughbred racehorse trainer. It's a profession that takes an inordinate amount of dedication, an extraordinary commitment and perseverance. And nice enough here to join us tonight on Trainer Talk is Bob Hess Jr., somebody who has shown that dedication and perseverance, and it's worked out pretty darn well. He's a 48-year-old native of Chula Vista, California. Like so many trainers we've talked to on this show, he's followed in his father's footsteps, and it's worked out pretty good to the tune of 1,064 career winners, more than $34 million in purse earnings. And I now welcome Bob Hess Jr. to the show. Bob, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me on board.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And look, Bob, you're an intelligent guy. You're a Stanford graduate. You hold a degree in economics. And I mentioned this profession 7 days a week, 365 days a year. You most certainly had other options when you graduated from Stanford. Why on earth would anyone want to train horses for a living?
Well, both my parents always said, do what you love. Just absolutely do what you love. And yeah, the reality is, yeah, I did have other options. My dream was to play baseball, but I just wasn't quite good enough. And, yeah, I could have gone into other fields in life. But the truth is that a lot of my friends that I graduated with from Stanford actually, you know, I think I'm a pretty lucky guy because while we work 7 days a week, as you mentioned, it's a labor of love. And in a lot of ways, I don't really feel like I ever work. I do what I love.
Well, and you didn't waste any time when you graduated from Stanford. You hooked up the trailer. You took your truck. I believe I read somewhere you had about $800 in your pocket, and you took the horse trailer, and you went right down to start training horses as soon as you graduated, right?
The day after graduation, I think I got about $700 or $800 in cash, and my mom and dad loaned me the pickup truck and a trailer, and my dad actually gave me two horses, and we were stable at Hollywood Park. My first two starters were on July 4th of 87, and Mike Mitchell claimed the one off me. He ran last, and another filly bled and ran last, so it was not a fancy, spectacular debut at all.
Yeah, what goes through your mind when you're starting your career and you get those kind of results? What happens and goes through your mind in that instance?
It was frustrating. I'm a competitive guy like, you know, most of us are, and you take pride in what you do, and when the results don't come your way, you try to tweak it and improve and get better and better and better, and that's been pretty much my motto throughout my life.
So if you couldn't be a professional baseball player, then training horses was the next thing in line that you always knew you wanted to do? There was never anything else?
As a kid, I really am super close to my dad to this day, and my initial attraction to the racing world was just to spend time with my father. So, you know, if I wasn't doing my homework or playing sports, I was always hanging with dad. And, you know, that then grew into the love of the racehorse and the whole racing culture, the lifestyle. It's just, it's hard to describe, but it's just a great world, and you get to spend time with so many interesting horses, interesting people from all over the world, and I think it gives you time to spend with your family and kind of bring them out to your workplace as well.
Of course, if people don't realize it, your dad also a very successful horse trainer and still is to this day. But how involved was he when you were growing up? Like you mentioned playing baseball and playing all the way through high school and then playing even at Stanford. I believe you were on the freshman team at Stanford. How involved was he in your baseball career growing up? Was he a coach or anything like that?
He was a heck of a basketball player, actually, in the state of Pennsylvania. And I think his dream would have been for me to play basketball, but it just wasn't, one, I wasn't good enough, and two, it wasn't in my heart. But, you know, he on Sunday afternoons and Saturday afternoons, he would take my brother and I and, you know, throw tons of batting practice to us. He'd hit us a ton of fly balls, ground balls. He's a horse trainer, so he's busy, but he made time to be at all of our games and really have a one-on-one approach with both of the boys and trying to make us better athletes and probably, you know, harder workers as well.
So what was his reaction when you said, Dad, I want to follow in your footsteps. I want to be a trainer.
I think he knew before I even told him. And as I said, they both want us to just be, you know, happy and doing what we love. And that's what I'm doing. I've been doing it forever.
So as a kid, how much time were you spending at the barn with your dad?
The only thing that got in the way of it, even my schoolwork, I would take and, you know, do homework in the afternoons after school. But if I was playing sports, which is time-consuming, obviously, that cut into it. But pretty much every Saturday, Sunday, I was at the track. And when I got my car at 16, whenever I didn't have practice, I would drive out to Golden Gate or Bay Meadows and catch the last couple and typically bring friends out with me.
Do you have a favorite memory that still sticks out to you about being at the barn with your dad and watching his horses?
One of the neatest races I ever saw was one of my more exciting moments. I think I was about maybe 6 or 7 years old, and I'd never seen a turf race ever in my life. And they just installed a turf course at Golden Gate Field, and my dad's horse, his name was Rare Day. He won the race. And he set a track record. Now, I didn't know it because the track record at that time, it was one of the first turf races ever. So, you know, it wasn't much of an accomplishment. But in my young way of thinking, I just seen a beautiful horse win on the turf for the first time. And he was a track record holder as well.
Wow. And before your dad even got to training at Golden Gate in Northern California, he was located at Caliente. And of course that track no longer in existence. It burned down in, I guess, 1970 before you guys relocated to San Francisco. What do you remember? Do you remember anything about that day when the track actually burned down?
You know, we were in our car, and there's four of us, four kids and my two parents. And we were actually watching a movie at a drive-in movie theater. And because we lived right on the Mexican border in a little town called San Ysidro. And I remember looking across the valley and seeing this glow in the sky. And it turned out that it was actually the grandstand burning down. Obviously, we didn't know it at the time, but that's what it was.
Wow. Wow.
That wasn't the best.
Yeah, I know. So, how did your dad handle that? And did he make the decision immediately to go to San Francisco?
I was a young kid, but I believe he went to San Francisco. And for about a year, we were without dad, and my mom had just had my little sister, so she had four kids under the age of six and no husband around. But within a year, he moved his horses, all of us up there, and we never looked back. It's been a great life. Yeah, I'm the only one who got the horse racing bug of the four. I'm the oldest of the four kids. But it's been a wonderful life, and we all, I know, have a great, great respect for our parents.
Really? None of your other siblings are involved?
No, they're not. We were always around and helping out, but never took, I was the only one that took it to the next level.
Wow. Do they come out to the races, though, and watch your horses run and follow you?
You know, my brother, who's a year younger than me, married actually a very intelligent girl who happened to be galloping horses at Del Mar one summer, and he met her there, and ended up marrying her, so she drags him out there every now and then. But for the most part, they stick to their own worlds and their own families, and they're very supportive, but not gamblers nor really racing fans.
Bob Hess Jr. joining me on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Bob, you became an assistant trainer to your dad in 1983, and I had read somewhere that you said your dad said that you had to learn from your own mistakes and make mistakes. Has that been the lesson that, that he's instilled in you that you still kind of take with you today?
I mean, unfortunately, I make too many mistakes. I think I've been able to learn from them even to this day. But the interesting thing, when I was a little kid, I mean, he rode me and all of us really real hard. Both our parents were really, really tough. And he sent me down to Del Mar in 80, I think it was before I went to my freshman year at Stanford, so the summer of 83, and with about six of his horses, and he did not call me one time. It's like he busted my chops day in, day out, but when I was gone, you know, if I wanted to call him, fine. If not, he was not going to call me. And he, obviously I called him all the time, but he never once bothered me.
Wow. Well, you said you're very close with him even to this day. Was he hard on you when you were his assistant trainer?
Yeah, he's a tough guy, but I tell you, he's, and I, both my parents really, but they're very tough, very, very old fashioned. My mother's Mexican. I think that says a lot right there. And my dad was raised as a farmer, really, in Pennsylvania. So they learned old school, and they were real tough, but also very loving.
Well, you get your first victory at Del Mar on July 31st. What do you remember about that day and how special that had to be?
that horse, Parlor Piano, the first race at Del Mar that day in a 10 claimer, I believe. He was, I don't want to say crippled, but he was an old war horse. And my dad had claimed him, I think, for $4,000 or $5,000 for a fellow named Clyde Hadley and his son Todd Hadley, who are still friends. And they're horse gamblers for the most part. I think professional gamblers, actually. And I, when we won that race, literally, it was, I felt like goosebumps all over, and I can still feel it. It was definitely one of my top one or two wins in my career.
How'd you celebrate that night?
I was just a kid. Nothing too fancy. I think I was barely 22.
And then your first stakes winner came not too long after that. Well, I guess it was almost a year after that. It came at the Solano County Fair. Is that right?
Busy Boy.
Yeah.
That was a horse that we claimed. And Dad always said to if a horse had never routed, if he showed speed sprinting, tried to route him. So we claimed this horse, I think, for around $20,000, and he stopped going short. But at Dad's advice, we stretched him out, and he got good and ended up being a nice claim for us.
Yeah, that turned out okay. Another horse that turned out okay was a little horse by the name of River Special, who gave you your very first Grade 1 win in the Del Mar Futurity in 92.
Right now I'm standing in a paddock at Gulfstream as we speak. And, yeah, he was a really, really nice horse. And in 92, he had a breathing problem. Otherwise, he would have won. But he ran a heck of a third in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. Gilded Time won. I think we got beat about a half a length that day. I had my son with me. He was on my shoulders. He was about 11 months old at the time. So that race, I'll die thinking of that race. So that was a great race. And, yes, he did give us our first Grade 1 about a month later in the Hollywood Futurity. And my good friend Kent DeZormo, who was scheduled to ride him that day, had I think he broke his wrist a week or two earlier. So we had Lafitte and Kai on board that day.
That's not a bad backup.
No. And you know what? Lafitte, he's a class guy. And what I always admired about him, he did not have to use a whip. He just powered the horses home with his will and strength.
Yeah, he was absolutely remarkable and somebody who was so dedicated to his profession. You could see why he was able to achieve the things he was able to achieve, right?
Yeah, and you want to talk about dedication and structure. That guy there, I mean, he still looks like he could ride, and he always had to fight his weight. So for him to look as lean as he does now, I mean, he is just a model citizen and really someone a lot of people, not only jockeys, but people should try to emulate.
Did you have a go-to rider that you would try to use in big spots?
You know, my main guy was P. Val, and he went on one of his, you know, his whatever.
Yeah.
And he disappeared for a few months. And at the time, Kent DeZormo was just coming into town, into Santa Anita, and we just got on fire and ended up winning titles together. And, you know, Kent, he's in the Hall of Fame, you know his story, but we always just had great karma. another great rider and a great, great gentleman is Eddie Delahousse. I always tried to ride him when the money was down. And even Jerry Bailey, I think I probably am about 60% wins with Jerry Bailey.
You mentioned the word karma. How important is it to have that relationship and that chemistry between a trainer and a jockey?
I think it's critical. I don't like telling their people how to do their job. And if there's a mutual trust and a mutual respect and admiration, then, you know, the jockey comes in the paddock and he knows you're not wasting his time. He knows that he or she knows that you believe in them. And I think they ride just a little bit better for you when they feel that about you.
We mentioned River Special and being so successful in 1992. That year was really a magical year for you. You had 105 wins, $2.6 million in purses. And if I'm not mistaken, you were ahead of Charlie Whittingham, Dwayne Lucas, Ron McAnally, Gary Jones in number of wins. What is that like? What was that year like for you?
Well, it was a wonderful year. I mean, the game's been great to me, and you don't have those years all the time, but it's something you appreciate, and you can look back and learn from it and hopefully do it again.
Yeah, could you ever imagine that your name would be mentioned ahead of the likes of Whittingham and Lucas and McAnally and those Hall of Famers?
I wouldn't say I was ahead of them. They had a lot to do with me other than my doing well, other than learning from my father. I often would talk to Charlie. I remember he helped me win the Del Mar Derby in Oceanside with a horse named Guide. It was the first horse I'd ever imported from out of the country, and he gave me a lot of tips. Lucas, the best ever. His feeding program, they spare no money at all. They go first class. And Bobby Frankel, on the outside, he seemed rough and tough, but he actually was a sweetheart of a guy. And whenever I had a question, I was able to ask him and learn from him as well.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, Bob, because we hear that a lot on Trainer Talk, that so many trainers, even though they compete against each other now, as trainers were coming up and learning the game, they got help from so many of the people that they're now competing with. And that's a great dynamic and an interesting dynamic to thoroughbred racing.
Well, I mean, look at Todd Fletcher. I mean, the ultimate CEO, ultimate horseman, class guy, confident, humble, you know, very well-spoken. He learned a lot from Wayne, and I guarantee you, he gives a lot of the credit to Wayne. And his father, don't get me wrong, and I think Wayne's proud of that as well.
Bob Hess Jr. on Trainer Talk, presented by Fazit Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bob, what would you say if you could pick one or even two moments that you would say, these are my career highlights to this point, or most memorable moments of my career to this point, maybe is a better way to put it. What would those be?
Well, being the youngest trainer to ever win the title at Del Mar, and also in the history of Hollywood Park, the training title, that is, that's special, that I can maybe keep forever. Records are made to be broken, but I was pretty young at the time. Winning the DeFrancis Dash, a grade one, with Slurp in the slop at Laurel in 02, I believe, was a great, great moment, great race. We flew out of town and got the money. Winning the Hollywood Futurity, Del Mar Futurity, the Norfolk at Santa Anita with River Special, those are great races. I just try to look at it and just try to be consistent and always do better, improve, learn from everyone around me, and continue to go forward and look for that horse that maybe could get us into the Kentucky Derby someday.
Well, you know, when we talked about your athletic background a little while ago, you mentioned being really competitive. And has that spilled over into training horses as well? And is it difficult to take losing as a trainer?
It really is. I was talking to my older son, Garrison, the other day, and I said, training racehorses isn't as easy as it looks. I was accustomed to studying harder, harder and harder and harder until I got straight A's. I was accustomed to taking more BP, more infield, more outfield, you know, working on my pitching and succeeding. And in horse racing, I mean, you definitely have to work your rear off, but you don't always see the result overnight. It takes a lot more patience. So it can be difficult on the psyche, but you just need to stay the course and do what you believe in, and ultimately the numbers will show what you the truth.
Yeah, and unlike those other sports, it's somewhat out of your control to an extent. You can do everything to get the horse ready, but once he goes to the gate and you give the rider a leg up in the paddock, it's basically out of your hands at that point. That must be a little frustrating at times.
Yeah, and it can be, you know, frustrating yet surprising. Sometimes you pull one out of the hat. I remember I had a filly, there was a speed filly named Manipulate, and Gary Stevens is riding her for us, and she'd go to the front stop, win a couple here and there. She gets left in the gate, and now she's 15 back, going 7/8, wins by 3 or 4. We learned how to ride her. Gary learned how to ride her, and he was creative and innovative and didn't panic when we got left in the gate. He just did his best impression of Cool Hand Luke, played it cool, and ran him down.
You had a quote somewhere that said, the horses talk to you. If you listen to them, they'll tell you if they're ready to run. Does that kind of sum up your training philosophy?
Absolutely. And I don't think that's much different than anyone else. We just need to... I love looking in the horse's eye, looking at their hair coat, their body language, you know, how they handle themselves in the stall, on the racetrack. Like most good trainers, the horse will tell you. We just need to be there to listen.
So how about a horse that you're never going to forget? It doesn't even have to be a big name horse, but is there a horse or two in your career that you say, boy, this is a horse I'm always going to remember?
Well, we've got a lot of good ones. I would have to say that my first good horse, and a lot of the crowd won't know him necessarily, but we claimed him for $40,000 as a late two-year-old. His name was Slurp, S-L-E-R-P. And by midway through his three-year-old year, he was winning, you know, top stake races in Southern California. We ran him in the Riva Ridge. I think it's a Woody Stevens. He didn't run well that day. But he won state races going short and long in Chicago. And he got beat a nose the day before the Breeders' Cup in 92 in a 7/8 race at Gulfstream. He won races in New York, Del Mar. He was a heck of a horse. And I think he earned about $500,000. But he just had heart. I mean, he never lost a photo. He would give you his life. And I still have a scar where once I was walking by his stall and he hit me in the bicep and dragged me into the stall. So he was a tough son of a gun.
He bit you in the bicep.
Say again?
He bit you in the bicep.
He bit me in the bicep and dragged me into the stall. He was the meanest horse ever. But a cute little story. My now 22-year-old son had flown to that Breeders' Cup with us when he was 11 months old, and he was actually standing and walking by then. And I had turned my back, and he had walked up to Slurp and started to pet Slurp. And I turned around and said, oh, my God, he's going to kill Garrison. And nope, he was just sniffing on Garrison, and Garrison was petting him. And he was licking Garrison on his bald head. And that horse is really, really smart. I think that has a lot to do with a horse succeeding as well. It's like any athlete or businessman. You need to be confident but intelligent as well.
You know, I've heard that about several horses that are hard to handle or have a bit of an attitude, is that when they have children around them, they become very docile and they're very great. They're great with kids. Is that true?
Another little story, and it's not a horse I trained. Pinata was known for all her antics where she would like pound her hoof, you know, on the ground in the paddock and in the post raid. So I had this lady who was on her pretty much her deathbed, and her dying wish was come visit Zenyatta. So I asked the sheriff if we could bring her over there. And he said, yeah, no problem. So they had her out grazing, and there's about 100 people there every day. It was after she lost her final race. And her rider, I'm blanking on his name right now, said, yeah, bring her up there. And I said, are you sure? And he said, yeah, wheel her up right in front of Zenyatta. Are you sure? Because she's probably going to paw the lady to death. He said, no, trust me. Zenyatta, they wheeled this lady right up to Zenyatta's chest. Zenyatta put her head over the lady's chest and fell asleep in the lady's lap for about 2 minutes.
Wow.
It's just an awesome filly.
Wow. It's like they know.
She knew.
Yeah. It's like they know. It's incredible. I've heard so many stories like that. It's just the remarkable animals. They really are. So, Bob, only a few minutes left here, believe it or not, but if you were to pick a couple of things on your bucket list that you still have yet to accomplish, what would those be?
Well, I'd like to win a Breeders' Cup race for sure. And obviously the Derby, but that's not the end-all be-all. It was a goal of mine when I was young, but I didn't really realize how tough it is on a horse physically and mentally to win that race and how much you could actually damage a horse by trying. So I'd say Breeders' Cup races, both short and long, and one or two on the turf as well. I love turf racing, followed by Breeders' Cup and Oaks.
Are there things you now have to do with your operation? If you're pointing for those kind of goals, do you have to structure things a little bit differently or look for different types of horses?
Well, you're limited somewhat by your budget and your client's budget. But yeah, I think good horses can come from all over. You don't have to spend, you know, $1 jillion to get that top horse. Look at Wise Dan. He didn't cost much at all. So they come from all over, and I think you just keep your ears and eyes open and try to be in the right place at the right time.
Are you still a big baseball fan?
I am. And, you know, I'm not really a fan of any team in particular, both in football and baseball. I just like to watch guys that I respect and like. You know, in football, obviously, Andrew Luck, Stanford grad. That guy I'd love to meet someday. He seems like just a class act.
Yeah.
And, you know, in baseball, I always liked Ken Griffey a bunch. He just seemed like a wonderful ball player to me and a great guy.
Did you have a baseball idol when you were growing up?
You know, we were in the era when the Oakland A's were awesome. And that whole, in the 70s, early 70s, that whole crew, you know, Raleigh Fingers, Sal Bando, Joe Rudy, you know, the Campaneras, Blue Moon Auto, and Vita Blue, they just had a great, great, great team chemistry.
So when Bob Hess is not around the racetrack, which I know is very rare, what other things do you enjoy doing when you can finally get away?
You know, when my kids were in school and playing sports, I was always at those events. My youngest son is actually 20, and he's playing rugby for Cal Berkeley, which has the best program in the country. And I'll be flying to watch him on February 1st play Oregon at Berkeley. So I exercise quite a bit. It doesn't really reflect itself in what you see, but I try to do about an hour a day in the gym and pretty much just read the form and go back to the races. I'm in bed by 8 o'clock every night.
Rugby. Did you have to work with him on that? Like your dad worked with you throwing batting practice. Did you help him out with rugby?
He's a tough kid. Talk about competitor and work ethic. I'm extremely proud of him for that. And he was just a cut below football-wise, a couple of the D1 offers. So he's going to Cal, getting a great education. And I even wear that Cal shirt every now and then, which I get teased about, but blood before anything else.
Absolutely. All right, well, Bob, I appreciate you taking the time to be with me. It's been great to hear your story, and all the best achieving those goals of winning a Breeders' Cup race and a Derby as well.
Thanks for your time, Mike.
All right, thanks so much, Bob Hess Jr., here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Great visit. A lot of fun. Great stories. Very talented baseball player. Rotator cuff may have sidelined him before getting to Stanford. Really smart guy. All right, second half of Trainer Talk coming up next. Presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Stay tuned.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Where will you be this summer? The Fasig Tipton 2014 yearling sales will be here before we know it, so make plans now. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky will be held July 14th. In 2013, the sale boasted an average of more than $89,000 and a median of $72,000, and the percentage rate of return of 43% was the third highest of any yearling sale in North America. The Saratoga sale on August 4th and 5th is always one of the top international yearling marketplaces. The sales $295,000 average in 2013 maintains its leadership role, and with the highest percentage of profitable yearlings among all sales in North America this past year, it's the only place to be this August. New York bred yearlings are in the spotlight August 9th and 10th in Saratoga with a $430,000 average and major increases in both average and median in 2013. The New York bred sale is the most productive auction for the cream of the New York bred crop. So where will you be this summer?
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
HRRN Live brings you live racing from tracks across the country. Join Chad Summers and the HRRN broadcast team as we bring you live racing every Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on our new channel, XM208, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.net. HRRN Live is your source for live thoroughbred racing from coast to coast, only on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go to hrrnlive.com for a complete schedule of tracks and races.
This is Bob Baffert, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
This is the Horse Racing Radio Network, your home for racing's biggest events.
Mike Penna back with you on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. A special welcome back to everybody tuning in coast to coast across North America on Sirius 93, XM 208, and everybody listening worldwide at horseracingradio.net. Don't forget, you can go back and listen to all of our Trainer Talk shows podcast archived on our website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Looking forward to the next half hour of the show. Going to be joined by trainer Bill Gowan. An interesting story here. 80 career winners. They have banked more than $1.2 million in purses, including the talented three-year-old Rydon Curlin, pointing for that date at Churchill Downs on the first Saturday in May. And Bill Gowan, nice enough to be with me here in the second half of the program. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Yeah, happy to have you with me. And by the way, it's actually Bronco Bill Gowan, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Well, some people. Actually, the starter at Churchill Downs named me that a long time ago. Nobody's ever called me that before or since, but it just kind of stuck, it seemed like.
I think I had read that somewhere as I was getting ready for the interview. I said, Bronco Bill, that's kind of cool. Where'd the nickname come from? Do you know where it came from?
Yeah, I was working a horse out of the gates one morning at Churchill, and he started bucking, and the starter at the time, Tommy Wagner, started calling me Bronco Billy, and just kind of snowballed from there. So that's how that got started.
So does this mean you're cheering for the Broncos in the Super Bowl, or does it not have any relation?
Well, it doesn't have any relation, but I'm dang sure pulling for them.
Well, Bill Gowan, my special guest here. Bill, let's start. We talked about, or I mentioned, Rydon Curlin. This is a horse that you have on the Derby trail right now. I know it's a big deal for you because you don't get this opportunity very often. It's not like you're training, you know, 1,000 horses and you winning, you know, tons of races every year. So this is a big deal for you.
Well, yeah, you know, I bought one horse at the yearling sale that year, and it turned out to be Rydon Curlin. So, you know, the odds that are happening are pretty long, but we got lucky and got us a good one, looks like.
Yeah, and for people that aren't familiar with the story, Rydon Curlin broke his maiden by 7 3/4 lengths at Ellis Park last July as a two-year-old. He set a new track record that day. You mentioned purchasing him as a yearling. He was a $25,000 yearling purchase, and the minute he crossed the finish line, you started getting offers all the way up to seven figures. Is that right?
That's true. Actually, we started getting offers after his first race. He broke dead last at Churchill, circled the field, and came flying and ran second. So the phone started ringing then, and then after he set the track record, they really got serious. But we had two really legitimate offers, but my owner decided that he wanted to keep him in racing. So that's where we are now.
Well, you go from a $25,000 yearling purchase to a seven-figure offer. We know this game can change on a dime, Bill. Why not take the money?
Well, if I'd owned him, he would have already been gone. But, you know, it wasn't my final decision, and I respect the owner's decision. He wants to play the game, and that's why we're in the game, is to race horses. And so he wanted to stay in, see how long or how far the horse would take him. So that's what we're going to do.
Well, it took you to the Grade 1 Champagne this past year at Belmont Park. Ended up finishing third behind Havana and Honor Code. No shame there. And that was the very first Grade 1 stakes race you've ever been part of, right?
That's correct. I've run in some Grade 2s and 3s, but definitely the first Grade 1 I'd ever run in.
Was it a different experience?
Oh, it was a good experience. I'd been to Belmont, but it's been a long time, and we shipped up there with a nice horse, and he put in a great effort, so it was a really good experience. Plus, we picked up $50,000 in the process.
Yeah, that doesn't hurt. That certainly helps, especially when you end up finishing third behind horses like Havana and Honor Code. That had to make you feel pretty good that you were in that discussion and in that company.
Right, and we always knew he had a good horse, but he, he kind of put us on the national map that day with the anytime you can run third in a Grade 1, especially at a place like Belmont, you're definitely going to get some attention. And if he can run with that kind of company, you know he's a pretty good horse. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, and I had read somewhere that you were surrounded by some pretty esteemed company watching that race as well.
At Belmont?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all the top trainers, Hall of Fame trainers, and all of them were in there. Billy Mott, the Shug, the Zito. So it was great to compete against those guys. I got a lot of respect for all those guys. Matter of fact, I galloped horses for Billy Mott one year, so I know him fairly well. And like I said, I like competing against those kind of guys. You know, you're competing with the best.
Well, you know, you've obviously done several different things in the business to get to this point. So take us back to the beginning, Bill. How did Bill Gowan grow up as a racing fan, and what first got you hooked on the sport?
Well, I guess it was my dad that first got me hooked on the sport. He had bought a few race horses just racing around Louisiana, and we always grew up around animals. My dad had a vet clinic, so we were always around horses and cows and dogs and cats or whatever. So but my dad started buying a few race horses, and how I got interested in it. And then I went to college at Louisiana Tech. They had an equine program over there. And went through the program and graduated in 1988 from Louisiana Tech. And the next day I drove to California and went to work for Jack Vanberg. Figured I better try to learn something. So he'd had a pretty good track record putting out some good trainers. So I decided to go to work for Jack. And I wound up staying with him for 4 years.
Well, you couldn't have picked a better teacher. What was it like working for Jack Vanberg?
It was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun, too. Jack, he worked you hard every day, and then we'd go have fun at night. So Jack was just great to be around. And Jack likes to teach. If you don't learn something from Jack, you're either sleepwalking through your job or not paying attention, because he's going to make you learn.
Yeah, what kind of teacher was he?
Was
he a tough teacher? Did he really put a lot of pressure on you to learn the game and to do things the right way?
Definitely. He wanted you to do things right. He was going to make you do things the right way, or you were going to be gone. That's just the way he was, you know. One time he told me he was a perfectionist, and I believe him. He didn't want anything out of order. Everything had to be right.
Well, you know, it's funny, because we hear that about coaches.
Really good teachers along the way besides Jack. I worked for like I said, I galloped a horse for Billy Mott for a while, and I worked for David Vance. Was galloping a horse for him, learned a lot from Dave, and worked for Randy Morrison, learned a lot from him. So, just along the way, a lot of people helped me out, and those guys, I learned a lot from those guys, just working for them and paying attention to how they do things. They all won races, and they've always been pretty successful, all of them.
You know, it's interesting because I hear a lot of trainers, Bill, they'll talk about working for different people along the way, and it seems like they take little bits and pieces from everybody to make them the trainer that they are now.
That's kind of what I did. I took, watched what everything that they all of them did, and you take a little bit from everyone and just kind of apply it to your own program.
So what was the biggest thing you learned from Jack Van Berg?
Main thing is checking horses' legs every day. That was Jack's biggest deal. He had 60 horses in the barn. We checked 60 legs every day, 7 days a week. And you check their legs, and then you would train accordingly. If they had heat, pressure, whatever, you'd back off of them a little bit. That's the main thing I learned from Jack was I learned leg work from Jack, and I think he's probably the best that I've ever seen come down the pike.
What's your favorite Jack Van Berg story?
I don't know if I can tell it on the air. But Jack and I, Jack worked me like a dog, but we had a lot of fun in the process. I don't know. I've got a lot of good stories about Jack. Jack took me under his wing, you know, and he treated me like his own kid. I got nothing but respect for Jack. And matter of fact, he and I are in the same barn in Hot Springs this year, so it's gonna be fun.
It's just like old times. You know, he recently came out with his autobiography called From Grit to Glory. Have you read it?
I have read it. Yep, I read it and enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Well written. Chris Katulak did a good job writing the book, and I've always said they needed to write a book about Jack because they broke the mold when they made him.
Yeah, how fitting is that title?
Well, you couldn't make it any fitting. He's like John Wayne of horse racing.
So I assume you're trying to emulate some of the things that you learned from him, some of the things you learned from Bill Mott and from Randy Morrison, from David Vance, and kind of mold those all into what you do today, and that must be a huge help for you.
Oh, it's definitely a huge help. And like I said, all those guys have won races and are still winning races, and it's just like our incorporated, mostly Jack's program is kind of what I go on. But like I said, I learned a lot from all those other guys, and they all have great qualities of their training program, too, that I try to incorporate. Just watching them, what they do every day with their horses, you know, maybe after they claim one, see what they do with them or how they train a stakes horse, you know. Every horse is different, just like a human, you know. You got to treat them all different.
So you said you graduated from Louisiana Tech in 88. Of course, Jack won the Breeders' Cup Classic in 88 with Ali Sheba. Were you there for that, or did you come right afterwards?
I had gone to California in November, and Ali Sheba was back at Churchill. So I was never around Ali Sheba. I came to work for him right pretty much when he retired.
How about Bill Mott? What's the biggest thing you learned in galloping horses and being around Bill Mott?
Bill Mott is probably the most patient trainer I've ever seen in my life. And probably one of the most thorough trainers. He goes over a horse from head to toe every day, which that really impressed me. And just watching him be patient with horses, if they're not ready to go on, he never would go on with them. He'd stop and back off of them. And I learned to do that also. And down the road, you'll have a better horse, and they'll usually last longer if you do that. So that's what impressed me most about Billy Mott is just the way he approached training every day. He was probably the most thorough person I've ever seen go over a horse, day in and day out.
What about Randy Morrison, David Vance?
Those guys, I just learned a lot just watching them like claim horses. Both of those guys are great claiming trainers, and they've had their share of stakes winners too. But just watching them claim horses and see what they would do with them. Sometimes you would. I saw David Vance jog a filly for a month one time, and lead her over and she wins. So you know, just. And they both taught me to, you just got to watch your horse, see what your horse is telling you. One thing I learned from Randy Morris is you don't always have to train them real hard. If you back off of them a little bit, a lot of times they'll run a whole lot better for you. So it's just, you know, mainly just watching those guys and see how they approach training. And like I said, they've all been successful, and I picked up a lot of tips from all of them.
talking with trainer Bill Gowan on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Bill, if you could describe your approach to training horses, how would you describe it?
Well, I pretty much train them how their legs look and how the horse is doing. You know, if the horse is I just watch my horse every day and let my horse tell me what he's doing, how he's feeling, you know, what he needs. If he's eating, if he's real aggressive, and he's, you know, I'll train on with him. The main thing is just watching your horse. That's what I tell everybody. Checking your legs every day and watching your horse and see what he's telling you. Watch his weight, see how he's carrying his weight, see if he's eating everything, how his eye, you know, how if he has a good look in his eye or whatever. That's kind of the way that's the way I approach it.
So every horse is different.
Every horse is different, but a fast one's a lot easier to train, let me tell you.
Makes life a little bit easier, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it's not as much pressure trying to train one of those slow ones when you're trying to meet payroll. That's pressure there. Having a fast one's fun.
Did you always want to be a horse trainer?
Well, I guess it's all I've ever done, so I've never really, the only job I've ever had in my life is being on the racetrack. So, yeah, I've always, ever since my dad kind of got me involved with the thoroughbred, that's not really all I've ever wanted to do.
You know, I mentioned that you don't have the big super stables, you know, the size of a Todd Pletcher or even a Bill Mott or Bob Baffert or somebody like that. Is it a different approach when you're training a select number of horses each year?
Well, I don't think so. I think you have to... you have to train accordingly and go on. And, you know, if your horse is telling you to back off, then you have to back off. But I don't think it's any different than training a small stable than a large one. They just have more numbers to work with. And, in a large stable, if one gets hurt, you got 10 more out there. If mine gets hurt, you know, then I'm kind of on the back burner. So that's the only thing. But there's really nothing you can do about it. You still have to train just like you would in a large stable. You know, you have to get them fit. You got to train on them. You have to work them. And, hopefully they'll stay together long enough to win some races.
What do you remember about the day you won your first race? When did that happen?
Well, it was really exciting. Matter of fact, the jockey that I used was Terry Thompson, and he had worked for Fanberg also. Jack got him started, and Terry had the bug at the time, and he won my first race for me. So that was pretty exciting. And matter of fact, the very first horse that I trained, I claimed him for $12,500, and we made about $80,000 with him, and owner thought I was a genius. But
were you thinking it was an easy game?
I did go with the first horse I claimed, and that kind of got me rolling, and then just been doing it ever since.
Were you thinking it was an easy game at that point, Bill?
What's that?
I said, were you thinking it was going to be an easy game at that point?
No, I never knew it was going to be an easy game. I knew it was... We just got lucky and picked out a decent horse that was sound, and he made us look good.
What would you consider to be your best training job?
My best training job?
Yeah.
Well, I had a horse called Star Spangled Gator that had a lot of talent, but he didn't have a mind at all. He was just a real nervous type horse, and we wound up winning a stake with him, made about $230,000 with him. So he was a tough horse to train just because of his mental status he had. He could lose at any time. But to win, so we won six races with the horse, and he was sound the whole time. So I thought that was a pretty good training job.
You know, you had a couple of years just looking at some of the starters. If you go to Equibase, you can pull up all the starters that you've had year by year. And mm-hmm. Typically, you know, in the 30s and upper 20s and 40s a couple of years, but you had a couple there in 1999 and 2000 with only six starters. What happened those years?
Well, I didn't really have many horses, and that's about the time I was galloping for Randy Morris. I was down on horses, so he gave me a job galloping, and I would keep one or two of my own. So I was kind of doing that, and that's about the time my kids were born, so I was just kind of laying low, and then things started picking up a little bit. Said I've never had a real big stable and never really had a desire to have 30 or 40 head. I just enjoy being with the horses. You know, that's why I got in the game, because I love the horses, and that's how that came about. But that during that time, I was working for Randy and Polly Galvin, one of the best horses he ever had, a horse called Morluck. So
yeah. Talking with trainer Bill Gowan on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bill, you mentioned your kids. How many kids do you have?
What's that?
How many children do you have?
I have two girls.
Any
They're
ambition to be
13 now?
Yeah. Any ambition to be a horse trainer at all?
The girls?
Yeah.
I don't see them having any ambition, and I'm not trying to encourage it.
What
They're doing fine. One's in the volleyball, the other's gymnastics, so that's fine with me.
Yeah, there you go. What if they come to you one day and say, "Hey, Dad, I want to follow in your footsteps"? What do you tell them?
Well, I would give them every opportunity and try to show them, you know, everything about it. But I would tell them that it is a tough life, and it's, you know, like right now I'm in Hot Springs and I'm away from my family, and it's hard. But you know, you have to be with your horse also. So it's, but if they wanted to be a horse trainer, I would, you know, try to help them everywhere I could.
You know, it's interesting you mention it being difficult to be away from the family. We hear that from so many trainers because, let's face it, this is 365 days a year, 7 days a week, and this is what it's all about. And Christmas, Thanksgiving, whatever it might be, you're at the barn with your horses. Talk about the sacrifices you have to make as a horse trainer to be successful.
Well, you have to be there. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, unless you have really good help. I've got really good help right now in Hot Springs. And actually, I'm here in Louisville with my family here. I'll be going back this weekend. And but I've got a girl named Bridget Lambert down there that's working for me. She worked with Von Hemel for 20-something years, and she's really good with the horses. And I mean, that makes me feel better when I come home knowing that someone is definitely looking after them. But it's a sacrifice. You have to be there 7 days a week. The horses can't take care of themselves, so... it's a sacrifice, and the family has a sacrifice too, but they understand it. My wife, she grew up around the racetrack. Her parents have the feed business at Churchill Downs, Schulteis Feed. So she understands the business, not to say that it's not hard, but she understands it, you know, helps every way she can.
That's important. That support system is ultra important to so many trainers. I've heard that from several people that have appeared on this show. You galloped horses, obviously, for David Vance and for or Randy Morse, I'm sorry, and for Bill Mott. Did you ever have any aspirations to be a rider before you got into training?
No, I was always too big for that. I knew, you know, when I graduated from high school, I weighed 100 pounds, and I thought, you know, maybe, but that didn't last very long. first 2 months of college, I put on 30 pounds, so there went my jockey aspirations.
Yeah, it happens to a lot of us.
Exactly. But no, I never really thought about that. The main thing is, you know, I just always wanted to train horses, be around the horses. And, you know, we grew up around horses and riding horses. That's all we ever did. So that's all we were ever around. Like I said, my dad was a veterinarian, and we were around animals our whole life. So that's kind of how I got in with the training aspect of it, just being around animals, loving the animals, and loving horses.
You know, every trainer seems to credit their owners for helping make them successful. Talk about some of the relationships you've had with some owners that have really helped you get to this point.
Well, like this owner I have right now, Dan Doherty, he's been with me for 5 or 6 years, and he's been a really good owner. We've had quite a few horses together, nothing like Ride on Curlin, but we've had some horses that could run a little bit and had some success. We've won some races. A guy that first started me out, Gary Short, was a good owner. I trained for him for a long time. And, you know, any of those guys that will send you a horse and give you an opportunity and you know, trust something that valuable to put that in your care, then, you know, they're good to have. They're hard to find as a good owner also. Really hard to find.
Well, you know, it's a long way between now and the first Saturday in May. But you have a horse like Ride on Curlin who has shown you so much promise, so much ability. He comes back and he wins his 3-year-old debut, and now you're going to point toward the stakes races at Oaklawn Park with him. Just do you allow yourself, Bill, to dream about what that might be like if he makes it to the starting gate beneath the Twin Spires?
Well, I mean, that's what I've been dreaming about this since I first took out a trainer's license. That's the first thing. I'm going to win the Kentucky Derby. I didn't realize how hard it was to even get there. So to even get there would be phenomenal. And then to win it would be unbelievable. But, you know, I think that's their goal, is to get a horse to the Derby and hopefully win it. I think that's why most trainers are in the game. Try to run in the big race, the Derby, the Breeders' Cups, the upper echelon of racing.
When you have a horse like this, do you kind of feel like, hey, we're in the discussion now, we've faced some of the big boys, we've competed with the big boys, we know we belong, do you kind of get the feeling that this is your shot, and does that put even more pressure on you with this one horse?
Well, not really. I don't really feel pressure. I just tell my wife, I think this is more fun than it is pressure. You got one shot. I got one shot with one horse. If he doesn't make it, hey, I'm, you know, kind of back to where I was. But I'm going to enjoy the ride as long as I can. And hopefully it'll take us a long way for a few years.
Yeah, you have nothing to lose.
Well, I mean, you know, if you lost the horse, it sure would be something to lose. But
right.
It's, you know, like I said, it's not a lot of pressure training a horse like that. It's more fun than it is anything. Pressure is when you got a bunch of climbers in the barn and you got to win to make payroll. That's pressure.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Right on, Curlin. Not a claimer. He is pointing toward the races at Oaklawn Park to get ready for the Kentucky Derby. And Bill, want to wish you all the best with that along that road to Louisville, and really hope to see you there on the first Saturday in May.
Good. We hope to be there. Hope to see you there too.
All right, I'll end this by asking you, as I do all of our trainers, what other things outside of horse racing does Bill Gowan enjoy?
Oh, I like listening to good music.
What kind?
Well, I usually have it on the Outlaw channel on Sirius XM. So, you know, mostly country rock, southern rock, things like that.
Who's your favorite?
My favorite of all time, I got to go with my man, Willie Nelson.
What's the best concert you've ever seen in person?
Probably the best concert I ever saw was Bruce Springsteen at LSU in 1984. One of the best concerts I ever saw in my life.
Yeah, it's hard to
but
argue
Willie's
with that.
Willie's still my favorite.
Favorite Willie Nelson song?
Oh, probably Angel Flying Too Close to the Ground.
Well, there you go. And hopefully you'll be flying high over the next couple of weeks, my friend.
I hope so.
All right, Bill Gowan, my special guest on Trainer Talk. Bill, can't thank you enough for taking the time. Always a pleasure to hear the stories, and your story is outstanding. And all the best along that road to Louisville and the first Saturday in May.
Great talking to you.
All right, thanks so much. Bill Gowan here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. What a story. Here's a guy that doesn't start very many horses. Doesn't win very many races. He wins on average probably 5 races a year, maybe 6 in a good year. And here he is with an opportunity. This is a game, we say it all the time, this is a game built on dreams. And Bill Gowan living the dream with a horse like Ride on Curlin now. We'll see if that dream continues over the coming weeks as we make our way to the first Saturday in May. But what a great story. Can't help but cheer for a person like that. This is your shot. This is your opportunity. Make the most of it, and he sounds like he's really enjoying it. Says the pressure isn't much right now. Just wait. Win a couple of those stakes races down at Oaklawn Park. That pressure will mount. But it sounds like he has the right attitude, the right mentality, and want to wish Bill Gowan all the best as he makes his way through the Derby Trail. Been a lot of fun here this afternoon. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Don't forget to visit FasigTipton.com to learn more about the upcoming schedule of sales and deadlines to nominate your horses to those sales. Make sure you do that at FasigTipton.com. A podcast of this show going to be available on our website, HorseRacingRadio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And don't forget to check out our full 2014 schedule at HorseRacingRadio.net. We're back tomorrow here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Make sure you tune us in. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.